Great. Many of you will be familiar with today's guest, who is Dr. Michael Stingel. Dr. Stingel is originally from Wisconsin, but he first moved to Canada to do a PhD at the University of Toronto. He is a Canadian citizen. He came to Lethbridge in 1989 to take up a faculty position at the University of Lethbridge in the Department of Philosophy. He is now chair of the Department of Philosophy and also the coordinator of the editorial board for the Canadian Journal of Philosophy. Michael is active in many aspects of the community. He's been involved in different ethics committees and boards, both within Lethbridge and at the provincial level. He does research in ethical philosophy, and I think the topics he works on will interest many of SACPA members. These include evolution and ethics, the just distribution of healthcare services, euthanasia, and lines of ethical distinction between animals and humans. As you can tell, Michael does not seem to shy away from difficult questions. I'd like to invite Michael to the podium, and please join me in giving him a warm welcome.
Thank you all for having me, and thanks to Susan for inviting me to do this. I know I've got a bit of an uphill struggle here because of the out-of-town rule, right, that out-of-towners always know more than in-towners. So I know you often have out-of-town people speaking, and because they come from out-of-town, surely they must know more. But I'll try my best. And in fact, what I'm going to do is give you a puzzle that I've been puzzling about, and indeed leave you with that puzzle, because I don't have a solution to it myself. So I want to talk a little bit about the puzzle and what makes it puzzling, and break for a bite to eat, and then we can come back and puzzle about it together. The puzzle itself goes back to about 1973. I first encountered it when I arrived in Toronto to go to graduate school as a budding young philosopher around 1980. But the puzzle itself goes back to a fellow named Peter Singer and to an article that appeared in the New York Review of Books in 1973. The article was entitled Animal Liberation, and lots of liberation movements had gone on in the 60s and the 70s, of course. But one of them, which I think Peter Singer was an important part of starting, was a concern with animal rights and our treatment of animals. We had assumed that we could basically do not whatever we wanted to them. We could certainly eat them, we could certainly hunt them, we could certainly experiment on them. But there were certain sorts of things we really couldn't do them. We couldn't torture them in certain sorts of ways and abuse them in certain sorts of ways. So it's not like people hadn't been morally concerned about animals before 1973. But in the 70s, Peter Singer and others raised real worries about the range of things that we were allowing ourselves to do with animals. So the puzzle that he raised at that point is the puzzle that I want to talk about. And, the other thing I should say about Peter Singer, you may have heard his name. He's an Australian philosopher. He was going to give a talk in Germany a couple of years ago on euthanasia, and the Germans wouldn't let him in. He now has a job at Princeton. Princeton wanted to hire him. There was talk about the Americans not letting him in. He did get in. He's now teaching at Princeton. And it's not because so much that he was worried about giving rights to animals, but because he was worried about taking rights away from human beings, and in particular, severely impaired human beings. And this is part of the puzzle. He wondered, well, why, if we're so ready to kill animals, why are we so worried about killing human beings that have the same level of cognitive awareness and the same capacities for thinking about the world, both intellectually, intelligently, and emotionally? So that is part of the puzzle, and I think it's an important part of the sort of thinking that Singer has done, not just about animals, but about people. Now, Singer's article goes back to an earlier point of Jeremy Bentham's. Bentham, along with John Stuart Mill, was a utilitarian. And utilitarians wondered, what is it that gives human beings moral worth, or what they call moral considerability? What makes human beings worthy of moral consideration or worthy of moral respect? Is it the fact that we're rational, that we can think about stuff? And Bentham said, well, no, a lot of us aren't. A lot of us aren't rational. A lot of us can't think about stuff. People suffer all sorts of adverse events in terms of their capacity for thinking. And here he's thinking about genuine impairments, or people are born in ways that they're never going to be rational. And Bentham said, surely the line of moral considerability is marked out by the question, can the individual suffer? Right? We don't really care, can they do calculus? Can they do simple addition? Can they reason from means to ends? Can they select goals and ends for themselves? Bentham said, the question is no, can they suffer? And Singer's point, and what starts the puzzle, is the idea that, well, if suffering is what counts, well, then equal suffering should count equally. So if suffering is the morally important capacity that human beings have that make them worthy of respect, we all know what suffering is, we all know that suffering is bad, just as we don't want it to happen to ourselves, we wouldn't want it to happen to others. If suffering is what's doing the moral work, as it were, when we think about how we ought to behave ethically, well, then certainly equal levels of suffering should count equally. Now the question is, okay, well, how does that lead to a puzzle? Sounds sensible enough. Suffering counts morally, equal levels should count equally. Well, think for a moment about something like chimpanzees. So another primate like us lives in tight social groups. They are the sorts of creatures that some people anyway hunt and kill, probably not any of us here, but certainly in parts of Africa they are being hunted and killed. Their habitat is being destroyed, and that's certainly something that we are connected to, and even if we're not directly destroying their habitat. We are connected to the destruction of their habitat in a way that we probably aren't directly connected to the hunting and killing of them, though the hunting and the killing of them might be connected to the destruction of their habitat as well. We also certainly seem to think that it's okay to experiment on them and to do things to them that we would never do to a human being. On the other hand, chimps are social creatures. They're capable of certainly physical suffering, and they're capable of emotional suffering as well. If you break up their social relationships, they're pretty unhappy. If you block their climb in their social hierarchies, they're pretty unhappy by that. So they're capable of physical suffering, they're capable of emotional suffering. They're also capable of empathy and fairness. They do respond to the suffering of other chimpanzees. They will go over and they will comfort them. They will be troubled by the suffering of others. They're certainly worried about fairness. If a fight breaks out, the alpha male needs to go in and back the underdog in that fight, even if the other individual in the fight is one of the alpha male's own allies that helps to keep the alpha male in power. So to be an alpha male, you need allies. And one of the crucial things about an alliance is if your ally gets into a fight, you back that individual. Otherwise, they won't back you, and it's important in terms of preserving your own position as the alpha male. However, if one of your allies gets into some sort of dust-up, say fighting over a bit of food, with a weaker individual in the group, the alpha male has to favor the weaker individual. So there are reasons for thinking that chimps are cued to notions of fairness, like favor the weaker over the stronger. They're intelligent enough to do the water fountain trick. Most of you probably remember this from your school days, where you get a bit of water in your mouth from the water fountain, and when somebody walks by, you spray it at them. Well, chimps are certainly capable of that. They're also capable of the more sophisticated version, right? Because once you've learned the water fountain trick, people are very careful when they see you going to the water fountain, right? So you learn that you have to go to the fountain when nobody's looking and then wait for them to walk by. And chimps learn that too, that once they see that you know that they've been at the water fountain, they won't spray you. But they will go to the fountain when you're not looking and then spray you when you're not aware. Now what that suggests is that they have what we philosophers like to call a theory of other minds. They know that there are other minds looking at the world and looking at them, and if you're going to do something sneaky, you better do it when one of these other minds isn't observing what you're up to. So chimps have all these characteristics, and if we do care about them from a moral point of view, and I think we do worry about certainly torturing chimps, experiments that go beyond certain sorts of bounds. We worry about the fact that they're being hunted and killed for their meat. We worry about the fact that their habitat is being destroyed. So we worry a little bit about chimps, but I would put it to you that we don't worry a lot about chimps. These things are too bad, but we're easily able to bear them. Too bad for the chimps. But now consider cognitively impaired fetuses and cognitively impaired newborns. I mean, severely cognitively impaired fetuses and newborns. The sorts of individuals who are not going to be capable of intelligent thought, who are not going to be able to experience empathy, right? Who are not going to have a concern for fairness, who are not going to be able to suffer in certain sorts of ways just because they don't have the intellectual firepower to do it. Their brain impairments are so severe that they can't think, and to the extent that they can suffer, they can't suffer a lot because they're just not as sophisticated mentally as a chimpanzee might be. Now, the puzzle here for Singer was that, well, we can do a lot of stuff to chimps and not care a lot about what we're doing to them. We can kill them and not worry too much about it. But when it comes to human beings, even human beings with severe brain impairments, we have to worry about preserving their lives. We worry about, well, should we abort them in utero? You know, would that be right? You know, wouldn't that be a terrible thing? Once they're born, we worry about letting them die. We think, oh, geez, you know, should we be treating them or not? Maybe we shouldn't offer life-saving therapy. And they're saying, no, no, we have to offer life-saving therapy. You know, should we euthanize them? Nobody wants to think about that, not in North America anyway. In the Netherlands, it certainly is a live option. But here in North America, we say, no, no, we can't do that to severely impaired newborns because, after all, they're human beings. Okay, now the puzzle here for Singer was, and the puzzle he gave me he wrote it in 1973. I stumbled across it in 1980, and I hereby pass it over to you now in the year 2000. Singer's puzzle was, well, shouldn't equal levels of suffering count equally? So aren't we being deeply inconsistent here? Chimps and other animals can suffer a lot more than some human beings, and yet we're very concerned about those human beings. We won't even let them die if that might in fact be a good thing for them. Whereas we have correspondingly much less concern for animals that are capable of much more suffering. So if equal levels of suffering should count equally, aren't we being inconsistent? Okay, now that's Singer's puzzle. Aren't we being inconsistent in this very regard? Singer put the point fairly forcefully. He gave a couple of examples. And he said, if equal suffering should count equally, if we're interested in doing experimentation, or if we're interested in killing animals so that we can eat them, we could do so, but under two sorts of conditions. So here's an example about experimentation. He said, okay, we can perform experiments in animals, but only if we're prepared to do that same kind of experiment on a human being that has the same level or same capacity for suffering. So yeah, experimenting in animals is fine, but only up to the point that you would be prepared to do the same thing to a human being that was at the same level of suffering as the particular animal that you're experimenting on. Now think about that for a moment. That would mean a lot less animal experimentation. There's a lot of things we're fully prepared to do to animals that we would never do to a human being, including a severely impaired newborn. And the same thing, he said, is, okay, kill animals and eat them, that's fine, but only if you're prepared to do the same thing with a human being at a similar level of suffering. So if you're prepared to kill and eat cows, ask yourself, well, what's their cognitive capacity? And if you're prepared to do the same thing with regard to humans that have the same cognitive capacity, then feel free to treat cows in that sort of way. Okay, so that's the puzzle, and that's the business end of the particular puzzle. You can do stuff to animals, but only, if you're going to be consistent, only if you're equally prepared to do it to human beings of a similar level of suffering or ability to suffer. Okay, so quite a puzzle. We might wonder about ways to get out of it. Is there a way to have our cows and eat them too, as it were, without suffering the consequences on the other side? And there are two things that I think we immediately think about. One is biological species, shared biological species. We want to say, but look, other humans are other humans. They're of our species. You know, certainly that should matter morally. Or we worry about social relationships, right? We say, well, look, severely impaired newborns are socially related to other human beings, and cows just aren't. So the boundaries of morality should be traced by the boundaries of social relationships. Right, so they should be traced by biology, biological categories, or by social relationships. The problem is that neither of those things work particularly well the more you start thinking about them. So let me think about them just a little bit more. Suppose we say, well, look, you can't do stuff to severely impaired newborns because they're of our same biological species, and biological species is what counts. Well, the problem with any sort of biological category, I mean, think about race, for example. People certainly used race as a kind of moral category, and the great discovery of the 20th century was that it worked lousy as a moral category. And we might worry that the same thing is true of biological species, that it's just not that morally interesting as a moral category. Species might be interesting from the point of view of biological science, but not particularly interesting from the point of view of morality. I mean, a simple thing to think about is, suppose we bumped into intelligent life from another planet, right? They look like us, they talk like us, they flew here, we flew there, who knows how it happened. We start talking and comparing notes, they've discovered calculus, they've discovered the importance of respecting other people and doing unto them as, you know, you would have done unto you. And at some point one of them says, hey, we notice you guys are a different species than we are, so we think it's okay to kill you. Or suppose we say it to them, right? Hey, we noticed you guys were different biological species, so it must be okay to kill you. They and us would probably start to think that, well, yeah, we're different biological species, all right. It means that we can't reproduce very well with each other or at all. But surely that's not very interesting when it comes to how we should morally treat each other, given the kinds of creatures that we are and that we're now talking together. Might be a better idea for us to morally respect each other, and biological species doesn't have a lot to do with it. And that's the worry, that biological species, like race, doesn't have a lot to do with morality. Nice lines that we can draw for whatever reason we want to draw them, but not interesting from a moral point of view. The other thing is that we expect our moral categories to be hard and fast, right? Either you're worthy of moral respect or you're not. The problem with biological categories is that they're not very hard and fast. They're porous. That's what genetic engineering is teaching us in ways that we can't ignore. So just in terms of thinking about it purely in a conceptual sort of way, biological categories are hard and fast. You're either worthy of moral respect or you aren't. Biological categories, very porous, easy to cross species lines. So the thought that moral categories might somehow equal biological categories, yeah, there might be some kind of loose connection, but they certainly can't be the same kind of category. So think, for example, of what we're doing to pigs right now. We're implanting human genes inside them, so when we take their hearts out and transplant them into human beings, those hearts, it'll be less likely that those hearts are rejected. Okay? Now, it's not that pigs are now human. You know, if we just put in a few human genes, somehow pigs become a member of our species. But if we put enough genes into pigs, yeah, we could start crossing species lines. We now know enough about genetics to know that, yeah, you don't have to do a lot of it before species lines get crossed. So they're very crossable. Now the other question more pertinent to our topic for today is, why do we get to use pigs to do this? Well, why can't we use human beings? Right? If we're worried about organ rejection, and we're worried that, well, pig hearts work pretty well, it's just that they tend to get rejected, so let's try to make them more like human hearts, and maybe we'll get less rejection. Well, why not just use human hearts? Now, how many people have read Kazuo Ishiguri's new book? I mean, one of his more famous older books is Remains of the Day, but he now has a new book out called Never Let Me Go. Anybody here read that one yet? It's about a group of people who find themselves institutionalized, and they're clones. They've been brought into existence as clones of particular people who are celebrities and famous and well-known and rich. In case these people have suffer a breakdown, right? They need a new heart, they need new lungs. The best of all would be not just to get another human heart, but to get a human heart that's exactly the same as the current heart that you now have, right? So in Ishiguro's new novel, the question is, well, what's life like in an institution like this, where you find out, because you're smart and intelligent, that, hey, we're all clones, and we're all meant for transplantation purposes. Our lives only go on as long as, organs are needed in terms of the people who created us and put us here. So if you say, well, why use pigs? You know, why not use human beings? The quick answer is, because human beings care. That's the point of Ishiguro's novel, that if you find yourself on a clone farm, this troubles you a lot. You suffer a great deal, and suffering is bad, so we shouldn't do it. But the question is, if we're going to do this, if it made good scientific sense in terms of not having organs rejected, why in the world would we make the clones intelligent? Why wouldn't we make sure that they were only as intelligent as cows, or maybe only as intelligent as pigs? Right? If we're going to build human clones, and we give them the same intelligence we have, yeah, of course they're going to suffer when they find out. And of course they're going to find out. They're smart creatures. But why in the world, if you were going to do this, would you make them smart? Why wouldn't you, as you're engineering them, engineer them to be just smart enough to eat and sleep and keep themselves alive? Right, so about the same intelligence level of a cow. So here's Singer's puzzle again. If we're prepared to do it to pigs, why wouldn't we be prepared to do it to human beings of a similar level of cognitive development? Now, I think the temptation of treating species lines comes as a result of religious tradition. And if you're thinking in a religious sort of way, all the species get made at once, right? And species lines are very rigid. And one species gets sent off, and one individual, in fact, gets sent off to name all of those species, right? So the species lines are set in concrete, as it were, or in stone tablets. So they're not so porous as we now come to believe that they are. And one of those species is made in the image of God, right? So if you think, okay, well, if that's the story behind the species, yeah, the lines are clearly drawn, and hey, one of these species is made in the image of God, yeah, then species lines do real moral work for you. You can say that, yeah, all human beings, however impaired they might be, they're all made in the image of God. And if being made in the image of God is what's morally important, all human beings are morally important. Now, the problem is that, of course, we've come to live in a religiously pluralistic society, and so we've looked to morality as a kind of shared set of values that will enable us to live together in that pluralistic society. So we now need to say what's valuable about humans without looking at religion. And so the question then becomes, well, how do we do it if we can't say made in the image of God and use biological species in that sort of way? Well, we're stuck looking at things like suffering. But I think there is this kind of residual that says, well, but truly species should matter. Well, it used to matter, but it doesn't matter once you can do genetic engineering, because then species lines are far too easily crossed. Okay, now what about social relationships? You might say, okay, wrong move. Biological species, yeah, we share that with other human beings, but it turns out not to be all that it's cracked up to be. It's not as morally important as we might have thought it was. But what about social relationships? You know, these severely impaired newborns that you're talking about aren't free-floating. They're socially related to other human beings. Well, again, the worry is that moral categories seem to outdistance social categories. Yeah, social relationships certainly are important, like morally speaking, but they're not the only thing that's important morally. Like, if I'm not socially related to you, does that mean I need to kill you? Well, no. Social relationships are important, but they're not the only thing that's important. We think that we might owe people moral respect whether they're related to us or not. So, for example, we might not be related to anybody in Africa, but if they're starving, we might have to do something about it. So we might have to go beyond our social relationships if we're going to respond to other individuals in an ethical sort of way. Well, why not say the same thing for animals? That maybe we should extend ourselves beyond our current way of understanding social relationships to include them. Now, you might say, well, but how can you have a social relationship with an animal? How could you be an animal's friend, for example? How could you be a father or a sister or a brother or a daughter of an animal? Well, consider the social relationships, again, that we have with severely impaired newborns and the children and the adults that they grow into being. To what extent are these human relationships? To what extent are they fictional relationships on the part of those of us who aren't impaired? Yes, we treat these individuals as if they're friends, as if they're brothers, as if they're sons or daughters. But that's fictional on our account. They're not really our friends. We don't really have a human social relationship with them. We have the kind of relationship that some people have with their cats or their dogs, right, where they have a rich and fulfilling relationship, or a relationship that they tell us is rich or fulfilling with their cats or their dogs. But the relationship is largely a fiction on their own part. And you can have this kind of relationship with goldfish as well, right? So you're going to tell me, well, the cats or dogs, pretty, you know, socially sophisticated creatures. Yeah, but some people have that same relationship with their goldfish, right? So if we can have social relationships with severely impaired human beings, we can certainly have social relationships with animals. Okay, in the interest of time, I'm going to skip to the end. I'm happy to hear. Lunch is on its way. I want to ask a quick pre-lunch question. In terms of when we kill individuals, we might wonder, well, what's wrong with killing? And the answer is, well, death. And so the next question then is, well, so what's wrong with death? And why do we think human deaths are such a bad thing, but animal deaths are not such a bad thing? So I have something that was in the news a couple of weeks ago. There was this Inuit hunter who got stuck on the ice floe. I have a picture of him smiling here with the guy who rescued him. It was a very daring rescue. Lots of wind, lots of cold, and that sort of thing. He's on the ice floe for 10 hours, cold, hungry, and most importantly, he doesn't have a gun. So the first thing he asks for is, please give me a gun. And the reason he needs a gun is he's worried about being attacked by a polar bear. And happy days, he is rescued, and he goes on to continue doing what he was doing, which was hunting polar bear. So there was a letter that was written, this is to the Globe and Mail, where I saw the letter, somebody writing in terms of the happiness of saving this hunter, and the real extent to which he was scared by being killed and eaten by a polar bear. The letter writer, Elizabeth Griffiths from Toronto, writes in and says, "When I read that the unarmed hunter was scared that a polar bear might attack, I wept. How do we think a polar bear feels after it's been shot and skinned? It's time to stop killing polar bears." Well, the quick answer to how we think a polar bear feels after it's been shot and skinned is nothing at all. It really doesn't care about getting shot or skinned once it's shot or skinned. And the same thing is true for people. Like, once we're dead, we don't care about it. So the question is, well, what is so awful about death if once it happens to you, you don't really care anymore? How does death harm us? Well, one way is to ask, well, what is it that we fear about death when we rightly fear it? And, you know, sometimes we don't rightly fear it. Sometimes it's not something to be feared. But what do we fear when we fear death? Well, we fear an end to everything that matters to us, our loves, our aspirations, our memories, everything that makes us us. Now, to have this fear, we have to be able to conceive not just of the things that we will miss. We have to be able to conceive of the world without us in it. Okay, so yeah, we can conceive of stuff that's nice, we can conceive of us not getting that stuff, but to really fear death, we have to be able to conceive of the world without us in it. Now, Freud famously says you can't really do that, right? Try to conceive of the world without you in it, and poof, there you are in the world, conceiving of the world without you in it, right? So you can't actually think about the world without you in it, because as soon as you do that, you're in it. Well, this seems to be a logical error. I'm going to a concert this Sunday night, or at least I think I am, and I can certainly think of my seat at the concert hall being empty. And I can think of all of the concerts that I might go to. I can think of that empty seat at all of those concerts. And indeed, anything that I might do in life, I can think of mine not being there. So my life is just one long empty seat. And I think that's what we fear about death, the emptiness of that seat, the loss of everything that's valuable to us, and in fact, us not being there. So we can all certainly imagine the emptiness of death, and I think that's what does make it a fearful thing for us. So who's capable of such a fear? Well, all of us in this room, I guess. What about animals? Well, some animals might be capable of fearing death. Elephants, for example, right? Any creature that lives for a long time, has complicated social relationships, we might expect to see them doing what elephants do, which is mourn for their dead. Now, maybe they can mourn for their dead, but can they fear their own death, we might ask? You know, do they have the cognitive wherewithal to fear their own death? With elephants, who knows? I don't know how we answer that question. Okay, but suppose we say that's what makes it wrong to kill certain individuals. the greatest suffering you can have is tied up with the fear of dying, and if you're capable of that sort of fear, it's just wrong to kill you. Now, it may be true that most animals are not capable of having that fear. So as long as you don't torture them while they're alive, there's nothing wrong with killing them painlessly. They don't have the fear of death, so there's nothing wrong with killing them. If we say that about animals, we're back to Singer's puzzle. Well, we should have to say it about human beings who are at a similar level of cognitive awareness. Take Tracy Latimer, for example. The level of awareness of about a four-month-old child. If we can kill animals because they don't have the fear of death, why can't we kill Tracy Latimer? And why, in fact, is Robert Latimer still in prison for having done so? So with that bit of the puzzle, I'll turn you over to lunch and to discussion and to some questions afterwards.